Thank you, Tammy, for such a sweet introduction. Hello, my name is Malika, and I'm an alcoholic.
Malika.
Yay, a voice. Hi. Hi, everyone. And as Tammy said, I'm definitely a crazy teacher. And I remember when I first came to the rooms realizing that there's a lot of teachers in recovery and a lot of teachers who are teaching who are not in recovery. And maybe we'll find us here someday, those who I was partying with in the last couple years of my drinking. It's interesting. In terms of how it was, what happened, and what it's like now, I didn't really have a clear perspective on how it really was until I got sober. And then after being sober for a couple months or so, I started looking back on my past behavior and being like, because before then, like many of us do, I was really good at rationalizing, and focusing on the evidence that proved to myself that I was not an alcoholic and ignoring the heaping pile of evidence that may suggest otherwise. But again, that didn't really become clear until I got sober and actually got sober from everything. Because in the past I had tried, controlling my use of different forms of alcohol and quit one thing for a little while, and my use of other things would spike and quit those for a little while. And it was, you know, like, but it wasn't until a little over three years ago that I actually stopped all mind altering substances and then started to get that clarity and working on my recovery. Briefly, what it was like, I started drinking when I was 16, which at that time I thought was really late. A lot of my friends, people I grew up around, had started using like closer around 12 or other times in middle school. And I was, you know, a sophomore in high school. I waited super long. But when I first started drinking, I think I blacked out the first time I drank and would always drink into oblivion. Like, I don't, from the very beginning, I never had an off switch. You know, there was another time when it was like Malika deciding that she had had enough, because that was a reasonable thing to decide. It would either be like there was no more alcohol left at the party. When I was older, it'd be like the bar was closed and it was time to leave. Or, you know, I was like passed out and asleep now, so I couldn't drink anymore. But there was never like me deciding on my own that it was time to stop. Some people talk about like the feeling relief right away. I don't remember that. I just remember, like, I guess there was something about throwing myself into just like total out of control, reckless behavior that was kind of appealing, because for various reasons, since I was a small child, I always had this like uncomfortable place inside where I just like stuffed away all the stuff that I didn't know how to process, from like weird experiences when I was really young that I wasn't developmentally ready for, to, my parents' divorce and trying to mediate their arguments before they divorced, for I'm the oldest of three, so taking on like a second parent role after they divorced and kind of being my mom's emotional, not kind of, being my mom's emotional caretaker and trying to show up for my family and ignore my own like heartbreak and confusion as a 12-year-old and all that stuff. I thought it was really important for me to pretend like I was fine and everything was cool, and I sort of hid that away. My teddy bear was the only one who knew how I really felt. I like wait till everyone in the house was asleep, or I thought so, before I'd really let myself cry, because I wanted, yeah, to pretend like it was fine. And I think that the freedom I found in throwing myself recklessly into oblivion was like letting go of some of that tension and control in retrospect. But I didn't see it that way until after I got sober, as I said. A few times my drinking spiked into like really scary, out of control feeling. First in college, and then it calmed down once I managed to graduate, which was a fucking miracle. At that time, I like piled on more icky experiences to add to that place inside. And throughout all of that was focused on like, okay, like I'm able to like go to class and like pass my classes. I've never been arrested. I've never been hospitalized. I don't drink every day. I never drink alone. All these things that were proof to myself I didn't have a problem, and ignoring the fact that, yeah, like I couldn't stop of my own accord, that I was doing things that I said I would never do or that made me feel shitty, and then would cope just by like sucking it up, pretending it was okay, and like partying again and pretending like it was fun and proving to myself and other people that like whatever weird stuff happened, like I didn't care or I could handle it. And then I managed to escape, graduate, came back, things calmed down for a little while. And when I moved to Oakland, the easiest way for me to find social life was in the club and bar scene. And again, my, you know, like I found people who drank the same way I did, used the same way I did, including some of my fellow teacher friends once I got into teaching. And then it spiked again and was, you know, drinking and driving in blackouts, all the stuff that I said that I would never do and felt shitty about. And again, was that same pattern of like pretending it was fine, rationalizing my behavior to myself, keeping things in that like place where I just felt was like, so I couldn't look at, finding some sort of equilibrium by my substance use and emotionally. And then finally I ended up crashing my car. And while drinking and driving, and fortunately, I'm super grateful I didn't hurt myself or anybody else, didn't get a DUI because I was able to drive my car home even though I had totaled it. So I got away without any on-paper consequences, but fortunately, that's not something that I was able to rationalize to myself. And scared me enough that I had already been introduced to the rooms in one time where I tried stopping some other substances. So that happened on a Wednesday night, and that Saturday I found a meeting and went there, and someone approached me and asked to be my temporary sponsor. The word temporary stood out as like, approachable. If they had said permanent forever sponsor, I would have said hell no, and I might still be drinking today, who knows. But I was able to think about it as temporary. We started meeting once a week. She took me through the first three steps. And it was in that time that I started to recognize like, oh, there's been a progression. Like crashing my car was the most extreme red flag warning sign that I was like headed in a direction that could become scarier and scarier. But it was like, oh yeah, there's the time like I couldn't remember where I parked my car. There's a time that I had like missed work because I had sprained my ankle so bad I thought it was broken in a blackout and didn't know what happened until I tried to get out of bed and like fell on the floor. And all those things that I had sort of pushed away. But when I started to look back, I said like, oh, there's been these warning signs that have been getting like slowly more and more extreme that I've been ignoring. And let's let the crashing the car without killing anyone be the last one before it keeps getting worse. I consider myself to have a relatively high bottom because I didn't have a lot of on-paper consequences. And that part in the book that says, you know, like as we raise the bottom, we can rescue some people for the 10 to 15 years of total misery. I feel like I'm one of those people. And if I want to know what that feels like to like have things be like really shitty, I was in the like fun with consequences phase. But if I want to know what it feels like to have all consequences, all I have to do is pick up and I could quickly learn what that is like. There was one brief moment where I thought that I might want to do that. My sponsor was like, my sponsor at the time was like, you could, you know, go try some controlled drinking and see if you make it back or not. And, you know, it's like, actually, you know, maybe not. Now that you put it that way, maybe I'll just stay. And I'm really glad that so far, I have been able to stay one day at a time. And it took me, I'm a sometimes slowly alcoholic. I'm have just over 3 years sober and I'm still working on my first fourth step at a super snail's pace. But I probably had a good year where I wasn't working any steps after those first three steps and that sponsor moved. I got a new one and she wanted me to do these worksheets that I didn't like. And I just sort of was stagnant for a while. And I started to experience, what it's like to not have emotional sobriety and like felt crazy. And like, I couldn't trust my own thinking. I get caught in like obsessive loops and not knowing if I was not being able to be right size. Like if something was upsetting me, it's like, am I being unreasonable or not? How do I know? What would a normal people feel? And spend like days, weeks obsessing over like how I should react to things. And yeah, felt like I couldn't trust my own thinking. It was like, oh, this might be what the steps help with. Maybe I'm not the only alcoholic that doesn't have to work any steps like I thought. Maybe I should try that. And so I finally have, and even though I'm not finished, I'm still on that fourth step, just admitting that I have character defects, using prayer, being comfortable with not being perfect, that I don't have to figure everything out by myself, has given me a lot more serenity than I could have ever imagined. I remember a point maybe a year ago realizing like, wow, not everything feels like an emergency anymore. Which meant that before that, everything had felt like an emergency. Like, oh my God, what should I wear today? Fucking emergency! Like, I better make the right choice. Oh my God, I'm going to get judged. Like, and then from, you know, little things like that to big things, everything was a huge deal. I had to figure out right away. I had to do it by myself. But realizing like, oh, they're like, if I don't know how I feel about something, I don't have to do anything about it. I can like eat some food, call a friend, call a newcomer, go to sleep, like decide how I'm going to respond tomorrow or the next day, or maybe I won't have to at all. And oftentimes when I was able to take that pause, things that in the past would have felt like a life or death situation emotionally, like often I didn't really have to do anything, like just time passing and my anxiety calming back down was all that needed to be done. I see that one more minute. So I'm super grateful for that. That has been one of the biggest gifts so far of sticking with my sobriety and starting to find some sense of humility, is that taking the pressure off of me needing to figure everything out and needing to be perfect all the time, which is where that emergency feeling was coming from. And yeah, so today, as I said, I'm moving pretty slowly, but I'm grateful to have like enough tools. I love gratitude lists and sending them to folks and just noticing how that really cuts through fear in a beautiful way. I've actually made real friends in program, which took a good 2 years of like the awkward get-togethers where all you do is talk about what step you're on and then you're like, what else do we do? I don't know. Okay, bye. I'll see you later. And like finally starting to develop true friendships, where it feels mutually supportive, able to talk about what's going on with me before I've figured it out first and like be okay with being unsure, being imperfect. And also recognizing times to be of service. I remember, when one of my family members passed and I was sort of freaking out, not knowing what to do with myself. And I called my sponsor and she was like, you know, be of service, do the dishes, like put the food away, like whatever, like that applies both in the rooms and in our real life where we can figure out like, how can I be useful to others and get out of our own head that way, even if it's something small. And yeah, so I'm just really grateful for the amount of serenity that I've experienced so far and how the skills I'm learning in A both can help me show up for my recovery and support other people and also like give me practical ways to deal with the rest of my life. And I'm really looking forward to hearing our other speaker. Thank you, Tammy, for giving me the opportunity to be of service today. And it's great to see all your cute faces in the little squares on our screen. Okay, bye.
Bonsoir, je m'appelle Tim and je suis un alcoolique. And aujourd'hui, je suis très joli. Never mind. Good evening. My name is Tim. I'm an alcoholic.
Tim.
Yes. And I'm grateful to be sober through the grace of God in AA. And the only reason I'm here and I said yes to show up and speak at the last minute is because I want to stay sober. So I keep it that simple. And then also I was talking some good shit in a meeting last night about service and then somebody called me on it. So now I have to live up to it. And that's what happens. Sometimes you talk shit in the meeting. That's all like program shit. Right. And then they say, okay, well now live up to it. And then you got to live up to it and it works. So, well, welcome all the newcomers. I tell you AA works. I'm here just sharing my experience, strength and hope, being true to my own self. So if what I say doesn't actually work for you, you may want to stick around and listen to someone else. Because one of the things when I actually was studying abroad, I went to some meetings in French. And one of the greatest things about a relief about the 12th step was that in the French language, where we say having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. But in France, that term carry doesn't translate into carry because they only use the word carry to physically pick something up. So the 12th step in French actually says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to transmit this message. So that means I don't actually have to get anyone sober. I just transmit my message being true to myself. And if someone's receiver is tuned into that frequency of what my experience is, it'll work for them. And then I still stay sober. So I'm not trying to sell the program. I'm just sharing my experience, strength, and hope. So welcome all the newcomers. And I would say AA definitely works. My experience is that it works when I use the books and I focus on the parts that are in black and stay away from the parts in between the black lines. Joke. And then, interesting, like I remember, and I always share this story when I kind of got sober this time, which is not my first time at AA. I went to this meeting at Mustard Seed in Philadelphia when I had around like 20 something days. And this was probably like my fifth or sixth time going to rehab. And I gotten thrown out of rehab and I was in this meeting. And I knew that every time I'd relapse and come back and they would say, are there any newcomers? I would love to say, like my name's Tim and I'm an alcoholic and I've got 10 days. And I loved when everyone would say, welcome back. You never have to drink again. It like, oh yeah, God, I feel so good. Thanks. Welcome me back. Right. And then these people would like even throw in some more and say, oh yeah, you're the most important person in AA. And I was like, yeah, that's right. I'm important. Right. You know? Not only am I welcome back, I'm important. And then I remember this one meeting I went to, and I had gotten this whole like line of like, you know, what do they call them? Like qualifiers or ornaments on my identification. So I wasn't just Tim alcoholic. I was Tim, a grateful, recovering, sober alcoholic addict, right? I added all this shit on, right? And then this guy Lou said, oh yeah, and I want to welcome Tim. Back there, who's, I can hear from the way he identified himself that this ain't his first rodeo. And he said, I'm not going to welcome you back and tell you you never have to drink again. He said, if you're an alcoholic of my type, he said that without surrender and acceptance, you must drink again. It's just a matter of time and place. And I was like, damn, ain't you going to like tell me I'm the most important person here? Right? And then, so I didn't have to go and figure out what he meant. He said, what I mean by surrender and acceptance, he says, is that if you're an alcoholic of my type, and if you keep fighting the first drink and don't simply surrender, you'll never win. And you're going to pick up the first drink and you're going to be off to the races. And he said, and what I mean by accept, he says, is to accept the 12 steps as a program of recovery. And when he said that, it just dawned on me that like for the previous 2 years and probably 15, 20 relapses, every single time the thought or the obsession to drink came, I tried to fight it and I lost every time. And sometimes I lost within like 5 minutes of the obsession kicking in. Sometimes I held in for about 5 hours, you know what I mean? And I remember maybe one or two times I might have fought it for a day or two, but then at some point when the obsession like came in to drink, it won, period, you know? And so I think it was that same meeting that this crazy guy named Carlton came up to me after the meeting and told me he knew where I could find a job. And he walked me around Philadelphia. And then we got to the bus station where supposedly this job was. And he says, oh, it's too late. He said, well, call me in the morning and we'll do a meditation. And he said, then we're going to start on the first step or do something. And all I said was, why should I do that? And he said, because I'm your sponsor. And I was just said, okay. And literally, I think by that point, after like fighting the drink for years and losing everything, I lost my job, I lost my condo, I lost my car. My mom kicked me out off the couch, said never come back. I was, like they said, as willing to listen as the dying could be, simply. That's all there was to it. So if I think in the previous 2 years, had I gone to a meeting and some guy said, hey, I'm your sponsor, call me tomorrow, I'd have been like, yeah, right, buddy. What are you, you know what I mean? I would have been like, okay, I'm cool. You know what I mean? I'm just here checking this shit out. But like this time when that guy said, I'm your sponsor, all I said was, okay, I'm your, okay, I'll see you tomorrow. Yeah. And so my sobriety date, August 3rd, 1990. And my home group is the Before We Retire. It's a Monday night meeting, 8:30, that normally meets at Rockridge. and it's only a 45-minute step practice meeting for steps 10, 11, 12. And what I mean by step practice is we don't actually discuss steps 10 and 11 because it's nice to discuss them, but I find that it actually works a lot better when I work them or use them. So we actually spend 10 minutes in the meeting writing a 10-step inventory and then 15 minutes meditating. And then we have probably no more than 8 or 9 minutes to share about how we're going to use the 10th and 11th or 12th step in our day to make tomorrow better. And the thing I shared about was service, and I go around, I don't go straight anymore. We'll get back to the beginning. The reason I think like service is like if someone says, can you be of service if I'm free? And I was free tonight when she asked, although I was hoping I wouldn't be free sometime tonight. You know what I mean? I was really, my goal was not to be free at 8 o'clock on a Saturday night. But when she asked yesterday, I was free. So I just said, sure. Right. And it probably works out that this is where God wants me. But like a very tragic story was like, probably when I had about, I think when I was coming to this first round, this last round, maybe like in 1990, I called my mother and I had told her like I needed some money to get something. And she says, I'm not sending you any money and you're not coming back into my house because I found out that you stole my jewelry and you forged my checks on my bank account. And I was like, but mom, if you don't let me come home, I'm going to die. And she basically on the phone said, well, I wish you'd just hurry up and get it over with it. You know? And this was my mom. And then fast forward to 1996, my mom was like critically ill in the hospital. And I had been sober now 6 years. And I moved back home to take care of her. Because one of the old timers in my group always said, or he mentioned when I asked him about what should I do. And he looked at me with this look of horror in his face. And he said, you never, ever want to have to make an amends to a parent after they're dead for something you could have taken care of while they were alive. And he was speaking from his own experience. But long story short was I moved back home. We set up a hospital bed in the house. And I got everything ready for her to come home. And I'm 6 years sober. And, you know, I had been like trying to do what I could do for her. And we went to the airport. We picked her up. And we put her to bed that Saturday night before Easter. And then Sunday morning, I got up to go do my service commitment, which was the 10 o'clock Sunday morning meeting at the Atlantic City Young People's Group. And I really did not want to take that 10 o'clock Sunday morning commitment because just like tonight, I'd always hoped that like Saturday night, I was going to be busy and that it would be so busy that at 10 o'clock the following morning on Sunday, I would still be busy, right? So I didn't want to take this 10 a.m. Sunday morning commitment. But this tragic part was we put my mom to bed. You know, we cleaned her up because she had messed herself and she was like really bad shape. And then that next morning when I went to go open the meeting at 10 o'clock, I went to go tell her I was leaving and she didn't move. And I went to shake her and she was cold. And I realized that like she had passed away in her sleep, like the first night she was home. And then as I'm standing there, like, freaking out, going, like, oh, my God, what do I do? You know, she's only home for a day, and I got all this. And, like, and I'm thinking, like, me, whatever, whatever. And then the next thought that came to my mind was that, like, well, you're the only person with the key to the clubhouse. So I, like, jumped in my car, and I drove to the clubhouse, and I unlocked the clubhouse. And I told my friends, some of these guys I grew up with and went to high school with, that, like, my mom had passed away. And like, you know, I couldn't stay. And they're like, well, sure you can't stay. Just go. I don't know why you even came. And I said, well, I came. So I went back home like 10 minutes later after I opened up the clubhouse and literally just going to the home group and seeing my buddies and unlocking the door. When I got back home, it was less about like, oh, my God, what do I do? I did all this. And it was more about like, well, how do I be of service to my mom, you know? And literally within like hours, I had called the coroner. I called my brothers and sisters. I called her brothers and sisters. I made the funeral arrangements. And then after the meeting, some of my home group members came over, you know. And I say all this to say was that like, had I said no to that service commitment Saturday and Sunday morning at 10 a.m. when I moved back home in January, and here this was April, and it was a 6-month commitment, I might have just freaked out that Sunday morning, right? And so now the way I look at it from that experience is that like whenever someone asks me to do service, It's really God telling me, this is where I want you at that point. If you have nothing more important to do on your calendar, not what you want on your calendar, Tim, but if it's not on your calendar yet, I want you here. You know what I'm saying? And that's how God talks to me, right? And I had a similar thing happen with my brother, you know, and I won't get into that, but I was working, I was doing area service, and I got a call one Saturday morning as I was about to go to the area assembly, and I heard this guy call and say, this is Detective so-and-so from the Brooklyn Police Department. And I almost just knew immediately he was calling me to tell me my brother had died. And he called, told me I found my brother had overdosed. And, you know, and I was like freaking out. But then I also had to go to this assembly. And again, I spent the whole day at the area assembly at the registrar because that was my service commitment. And I don't want to focus this thing on like, it sounds like, oh, God, this whole guy's story is about death. But like, by the time I had left the assembly at 4 or 5 o'clock that evening, I had already arranged everything to go home and take care of my brother and all the services. And the only thing I could share was, I don't know why this is important for me to share, but when I went to a meeting that night at 6:30, I didn't feel the need to share in a meeting that my brother had passed away that morning. You know, I was like, I had visited him while he was in jail. I had sent him packages. I had treated him the way I would want a brother to treat me. He was locked up for 8 years. And when he passed away, I had like no amends to make to him. And again, just that day of being around service, I was able to like take care of things without freaking out. And then by the time I got out of the assembly and went to a meeting that night, it was at left Lakeshore Lushes, up to my neck meeting. There was just nothing in me that said, oh, I have to share about this. I was at peace with everything, you know? So service works. So back to the beginning. When I got to AA 1990, this meeting started at 8, and it's 8:35. And Jamie, how long do I have?
Go until about 8:50, 8:55.
Okay, great. So I'll be done. So anyway, so when I got here in 1990, I had been coming in and out of AA for about 2 years. And this time around, I've never wanted to forget like that day, August 3rd, 1990. And I share this part of my story. So like I had like gotten up at about 9:10 o'clock that night. And this was Thursday night, August 2nd, 1990. And I woke up at about like 9:10 o'clock. And I went on my bicycle to go out to work. And by this time, after having graduated from college with a degree in computer science and worked as a programmer for about 4 or 5 years, I had hit bottom to the point where my job was going out at night on my bicycle and driving around Atlantic City through the casino and hotel parking lots, breaking into cars and stealing car stereos and anything I could find to sell. To get alcohol. And so I remember I was like out of my bicycle and I found this one car that was like about 2 or 3 blocks from the house. And I always had this rule of like, you know, not to break into cars in my neighborhood where I grew up because people knew me. But this night I just didn't care and I stole the car stereo and I stashed that somewhere. And then I had these tools and I went up into this casino parking lot and I'll never forget. And it was this big conversion van that had like, you know, you could tell like the tinted windows and all that stuff and the mag wheels. And there was just a feeling in my gut that like, oh man, this is going to be a good score, right? So I like broke into the back of the van and it was like the holy grail. There was like this big amplified subwoofer in the back that I knew was like worth 50, 60 bucks. Like car stereos were 20, right? But like I knew the speaker was like worth 50, 60 bucks easily. So I had this big speaker, literally like huge. I don't have anything around, but it's like big. And I strapped it to the back of my bike. And I'm like walking up Baltic Avenue, which is a one-way street going down. And I'm going up it on my bicycle, walking this big speaker, going up to the hood to sell the speaker to get some money so I can get high. And I probably was maybe like 5-6 blocks from the hotel when like the cop cars just like pulled up on me from like 3 different directions. And I'm like sitting there on the curb and they're calling things in and they're like, blah, blah, blah. And I guess what happened was it hadn't been reported stolen because I had just stolen it like 15 minutes ago. So the cop like looks at me and he says, "Where'd you get the speaker?" And I was like, here's the ironic part. I said, "Oh, I bought it off a crackhead, right?" And he's like, "I don't believe you." He says, "But I can't arrest you for suspicion of stolen property." And he says, "But I can't release you unless you have any identification." So I gave the guy my driver's license, and the cop looked at my driver's license, and he looked at me, and he just started shaking his head. And the cop just looked at me, and they're like, when I grew up in high school, and they called me Timmy. So he's like, "Timmy," he's like, "what the fuck happened to you?" And I was like, "I don't know." And he says, "Man, you need some help." And the scary part when I look back was like, I had actually gone to high school with this cop, and he didn't even recognize who I was until he looked at my driver's license, you know? So like that next day, which was August 3rd, I got up and I went off to do my last party, right? And I got like, I think I stole some money from my mom, or I had money. I know there's no way I had money left over from the night before, but I went and got like a 6-pack of like warm beer that was like $2.79. And I went and sat in this abandoned house that was a few blocks from my house, and I started partying. And by this time, my brain was so messed up that I was like suffering from paranoid delusions. And as I'm sitting in this abandoned house, drinking and doing some other stuff, I started to like believe that they had like wired this house with microphones and cameras, this abandoned house, and that like 5 or 6 blocks away, I could see this like detective in a hotel room window with a telephoto lens taking pictures of me, right? And then what always happened was like at some point during like my partying, whether I was at home or in a hotel or an abandoned building, and I used to even party on like vacant lots so I could see what was coming at me. But then I would hear the dogs, that they'd always like had these special dogs that they would like bring in to look for evidence, that they had somehow, and I had this in my mind, that they had cut the dog's vocal cords so they couldn't bark. And I could hear these dogs like yelping and scratching at the floor downstairs. And I destroyed all my evidence, right? And as I had done literally like 40, 50 times since I'd started like drinking, and hopefully it was the last time, I walked downstairs in this abandoned building with my hands up, and I surrendered to an empty house, right? There was no one there, no dogs, no police, no FBI. And if you think that after like doing this 50, 60, I don't know, maybe even 70 times, I mean, I did it in Philadelphia, I did it in New Jersey, I did it in Virginia, I did it in California, but like wherever I went, they were there. You know what I mean? They would just follow me. They were like, I felt like they were trying to build this like case against this like kingpin crackhead, right? And they were going to like lock me up for a long time. But like I was just that paranoid that like I thought they were following me and building a case. And maybe they were, I don't know. But that was the last time I surrendered to an empty building, you know? So I went to the rehab. Good. We got about 9 minutes, so I can throw some recovery in here. And I got kicked out after 15 days because I had been to this rehab 3 months before, and they said that I was a disruptive influence to the therapeutic community. And when I said, "Well, what does that mean?" And they said, "Well, you're full of shit and we're not going to be able to help you." So they kicked me out. And that's when I called my mom and I asked her for the money to come home. And that's when she said, "No, I just wish you'd hurry up and die and get it over with, you know?" And so here I was like in Philadelphia. My mom had forsaken me. I got thrown out of rehab. And the only place I had to turn was AA, you know? And so it was for me literally the last house on the block. So then a few days after making meetings, this guy, Carlton, told me he's my sponsor. And like literally that morning, that next morning, we went to a 7:30 meeting. And after the meeting, we went back to his house. And he gave me this exact actual 12-12 that actually still has the date in it right there, August 3rd, 1990. And we started step one that morning. You know what I mean? Like not a week later, not a month later, we started it that morning, you know? And so what I found out from reading, and he would tell me, like, he said, "So what does step one mean to you?" And I says, "Oh, I mean, I know step one. I know that one. That means I'm powerless. I'm powerless of people, places, things, drugs, alcohol, the weather. I'm powerless over everything. And then he handed me the book and he said, well, show me where it says that. And I was like, well, I was kind of reading between the lines. And he said, read between the white lines, not the black ones. So what I found out was he somehow pointed out to me the fact that I just could not say that I was powerless over alcohol was to him a form of denial. That I kept saying, I'm powerless, I lack control, I can't control it, I don't control it. You know what I mean? So he said, like, for me to move forward, I had to, without being prompted, say I'm powerless over alcohol, and had to say alcohol, right? And then what I found out from reading it was that I'm powerless over alcohol because of two things. This mental obsession, which when it would kick in, at some point I would give in and take the first drink, and then the physical craving. And once I take the first drink, my body craves more and more and more and more. And it's an allergy because it's an abnormal reaction to being intoxicated, which means being poisoned. And so for normal people, when their body becomes intoxicated or poisoned with alcohol, their body tends to send them signals to stop taking in more alcohol. I have an abnormal or an allergic reaction to it, is that when I actually become intoxicated or become poisoned with alcohol, my body starts to send signals to take in more. And that's not normal. And that's why I believe I'm an alcoholic, because the obsession and the craving. And then, you know, and my current sponsor says, well, if that's all it took was just admitting you're powerless, then we'd have a nice little one-step program. You know what I mean? You just one step, book about 5 pages long, and you couldn't charge more than $1. So, but there's 12. And so after I admitted that I was powerless and I surrendered, it meant that, like, I had no power against the first drink. And when you think about it, like, they talk about this thing, like, that was our dilemma, lack of power. And, like, it just, to these days, like, if you've been sober for a while, it makes no bloody sense that, like, how could, like, having a choice between going on and drinking for the rest of your life and destroying your life in this very miserable, horrible way that could be quick or could be slow, but then it also destroys the lives of those around you. So you have that choice or accepting the help of a higher power. Like, in what freaking bizarro universe is that a dilemma, right? Because a dilemma is a choice between two equally unpalatable outcomes. So how is accepting the help of a power greater than myself as equally unpalatable as the thought of considering drinking myself to death? But as an alcoholic, to me, those two decisions were equally unpalatable. So alcohol had beaten me into the open-mindedness when I was just about, okay, God, you're so, and here's what I said, and I hope nobody has kids around, you may want to hold their ears, because my first true second step prayer was, okay, God, you're so fucking powerful, take away this obsession. You know what I mean? And it didn't work. So I kept saying the prayer every day, and I almost said it like that defiantly. Okay, you're not going to give me any choice. You're so effing powerful. Take away this obsession. And the next thing I know, maybe one day, 30, 40, 45, 50 days, I don't know when, I woke up and I didn't have the thought of getting drunk. It just went away, you know? And then so I got another sponsor after that, and he said, well, look, he's like, the third step is really just a decision to move forward with the fourth step. And I was like, yeah, but I need to really, like, figure this third step out. Like, I need to, like, you know, make sure I get it. And he was like, no, he says, and I said, no, I'm a newcomer. I'm a newcomer. I need to take it easy. It's a step a year. And then he says, that's bullshit. He says, being a newcomer is like being a virgin. You get one shot at it. He said, you were a newcomer when you first came here 2 years ago. After your relapses, you're a beginner. He says, now you're on the accelerated program. So he sat me down with the instructions for the fourth step. And I would love to say that, like, I was willing to take his suggestions, but I was scared to death of what I was going to have to put on that piece of paper. I mean, what I knew I had done, that I knew I never wanted to tell another soul, scared me almost as much as going back to drinking. So rather than do the fourth step, I took the easier, softer way, which was to go to 2 to 3 meetings a day and drop like little bits of my past in meetings by sharing about it, you know? And then one day he came to a meeting and he heard me sharing about stealing my mother's watch. And he said, hey, look, I want you to stop sharing in meetings for 30 days. And I said, well, if I stop sharing, I'm going to get drunk. And then he says, well, if you keep dumping your fourth step 3 minutes at a time in meetings, he says, you're going to get drunk too, you know? And I really wish I had listened to him, but I was defiant. I was really afraid. I was like, there was like two things on my fourth step that were going to the grave with me. I'm serious, you know? And then so finally, after about a year of going to meetings and I'm on my fourth step, right, I got to the point where I was doing almost all the same stuff sober that I did drinking, lying, cheating, and stealing and manipulating. And when I finally got to the point where it was just like, okay, I'm either going to drink or I'm going to jump off a bridge because I can't own a gun, I just broke down and I spent like 3 hours and I wrote my fourth step, you know? And then I called my sponsor and we sat down probably 2 days later and we went through, I told him everything. And one of the ways he tricked me was he says, I know there's things you don't want to tell me. He said, so, but make sure you write them down so that they're between you and God. And he tricked the shit out of me, right? And he said, just underline them or highlight them so you know you're not going to tell me. And I like did it. I had those two things. I was never going to tell anyone. So we sat down for like 2 hours. I dumped my whole four step. And at the end of 2 hours, he said, okay, is there anything else you have? He says, because you can't stay 100% sober on 90% of a fifth step. And I was like, oh, fuck, right? And I said, okay, okay. So there was one time when I was 15 and blah, 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 blah. And he said, oh, man, that's nothing. Guess what I did? And I was like, you? And he was a minister, right? And I was like, wow. And then he says, okay, that's good. I'm glad you got that out. And I was like, he said, is there anything else? I had another hour of anything else's that night. You know what I mean? And what I could say was when I left his house and I was walking home, I had like this experience that I could only say, it was like this was a little over being sober for a year, not having a drink, was that like I went to meetings and I did service and I made phone calls because I was afraid I was going to get drunk. And then when I was leaving his house, walking home, and I saw like the stars in the sky, and I felt like there's got to be something out there greater than me, because I couldn't do that shit. I couldn't make stars. I couldn't build the heavens. I really had this feeling that like I was no longer like going to meetings or doing AA because I was afraid I was going to get drunk, but I was doing it now because I had faith that God wanted me to stay sober and this would work, you know? But like after sitting down and dumping that stuff with him, my whole attitude and outlook upon why I was coming to meetings and doing things changed from being afraid of drinking to having faith that it all worked, you know? And so we went on and made the amends. We stayed in service. And I would say we lived happily ever after. But, you know, I found out like one of the things I said just didn't work. Like I said, I didn't get sober to be miserable. And, you know, Brett, misery comes, you know? Just because you join AA doesn't mean you had this like bubble that protects you from life. You know, people die, you lose jobs, puppies don't make it. You know what I mean? And it hurts. And so I just basically had to like through misery and pain, turn more and more to the 12 steps in God and service. And you know, and I'm going to tell you, if you're out there and you're like me. And everybody's saying, come on, man, why don't you be happy, joyous, and free? The program says you should be happy, joyous, and free. It's like, you know, I didn't come in here whistling Dixie. I didn't whistle Dixie in high school. And, you know, I'm going to say, like, for me, like, being happy, joyous, and free has not been a requirement to stay sober. But, like, having faith in God and working the steps and helping others has been, you know? So when I can't be happy, I try to be useful. That's simple, you know? And so the latest thing was like moving into steps 11 is I found that like for some reason for being innately there's just been always this sort of like deep underlying desire to have a connection with something that could give me direction in life. Because I just always had this like thing like, oh, my God, why did I make that left in Albuquerque? Right. Remember Bugs Bunny? Like I should have made that left. And so like. One thing AA has given me is not just the ability to not drink, but it's also given me the ability to sort of like, when I get to Albuquerque, to like pause and ask for direction and listen to whether I should go left or right or just stop, you know? And that's like how I see the 11th step, is that like, it's not just about clearing my mind for the sake of clearing my mind. It's really about doing whatever I have to do to be able to have this conscious contact with a power that got me sober, that now wants me to live a happy, sober, useful life, you know? And as a result, like, things beyond my wildest dreams have ever happened. I mean, I don't want to tick them off, but like, you know, I got kicked out of graduate school when I was drinking. And after my mom passed away, this school gave me a full scholarship and a living stipend and a semester abroad in Paris to get a master's degree in business, you know? And then the next thing I know, I decide, like, I don't want to be involved in business because I just didn't like the way I felt doing what I did. So I got into the field of education. And then the next thing I know, it's like, not only did I get like a teaching credential and I got a master's, I ended up like sticking around and getting a doctorate, right? And I really feel like as I was doing all of this, there was no question that I should have made a left at Albuquerque, right? I knew that like I made the right turn, you know? So if you're new, I would say maybe get a sponsor, not maybe. Okay. If you're an alcoholic of my type, then I would recommend that you just surrender and stop fighting the first drink, and then maybe accept the 12 steps as a program of recovery and a way of life under the direction and guidance of a sponsor who has worked at least the first four, you know? And I found that like when we do that, the results almost always are that we don't fail, you know? So, boom, I got a minute left and I yield my time. Thank you.